Hey, I'm Josh Barrow, your new host of Left, Right, and Center. Every week, join Rich Lowry, Bob Scheer, and me for a contentious yet civilized debate of the week's big political stories, from ISIS to the U.S. economy to this 47-candidate presidential election we're having. You can find Left, Right, and Center on KCRW's iTunes page.
This is Hobo Town. That is Hobo Lane. I've had tons of places to live, but one thing I learned is that people need their own space, and I will never stay too long at someone's house. I always want somebody to want me back. I will never overstay my welcome.
That's a man who lives in a homeless encampment near the intersection of Santa Monica Boulevard and the 405 freeway. He'll only identify himself by his nickname, Rat Bastard. Homeless encampments in Los Angeles have spread far beyond Skid Row. The number of people living on the streets has gone up 12% since 2013. And now some neighborhoods are struggling to manage big homeless populations they've never seen before, like the area sometimes called Sawtelle. It sits about 4 miles in from the beach. It's not the fanciest part of West LA, but it's not a place where you would have seen a lot of homeless people a few years ago. Now, the man you just heard is one of many residents in a huge encampment there. Press Play producer Anna Scott recently went inside that encampment and has this story.
My name is Lincoln Briggs, and I'm a resident down here in Hobo Town, as I refer to it.
Lincoln Briggs leans back on a black couch on the sidewalk and looks around at his neighborhood. He sits on what used to be a quiet commercial street without much foot traffic. Now, tents and other living quarters line Cottner Avenue, more than a dozen in just a few blocks. They're made from mattresses, furniture, and tarps. Garbage litters the sidewalks. When it's crowded, you're hit with a smell as soon as you step onto the street.
I would like for us to be able to get a porta potty, a dumpster, and a spigot of water so we can wash. This is what our demand. These are our demands to quit being filthy hobos and an eyesore. This would be nice.
Encampments like this currently exist in a kind of limbo.
Mike, you're here in the station. Come to the training office, please. Officer Montague.
The cops in charge of patrols recently helped arrange new garbage pickups there, something residents want. But city officials say that is as far as services will go.
Well, we don't really want the encampment there, so I don't think we're going to go out of our way to do things to make it easier.
City Councilman Paul Koretz represents the district that includes the encampment called Hobo Town. I caught up with him at an event elsewhere in his district. Part of why garbage piles up, he said, is a new rule requiring city workers to offer storage before clearing homeless people's belongings. The city has lockers for this, but they're down on Skid Row.
So we legally can't expect the homeless to travel downtown to pick up their belongings. So at least at this point, we can't remove anything that isn't being removed for safety and health.
There's a lot of trash everywhere around the neighborhood that they leave behind.
Alex Platt manages a complex of music studios on the same street as the encampment.
They frequently park their possessions, you know, in shopping carts in our parking spaces. And we've had occasional, from the more mentally unstable or perhaps drug-using homeless, have made threats. It's very bad for business in general.
Platt's worked on Cottner Avenue for 12 years. During his first decade on the street, he hardly saw any homeless people.
We're all kind of blown away at how quickly it happened. 2 years ago, we were seeing maybe two or three homeless people in the area, and now it's a whole tribe of them.
I want to be a piano player, actor, ventriloquist.
Lorenz Peebles says he was the very first settler here. He landed on Cottner Avenue about 2 years ago.
It's a very quiet street. I was the first person here, so that's how that goes.
Peebles, as he's known, is 64 years old and has been homeless since his early 20s. He used to stay in Venice Beach, but as that neighborhood is gentrified, the homeless have scattered. Peebles liked the isolation of Cottner Avenue. There's a gym nearby and a medical marijuana clinic, but most of the other businesses here don't get many walk-ins.
I have to move every 3 months just to clean up the mess around here and everything, but I usually go right across the street and come right back.
One reason Peebles and others have been able to stay is a fence. A chain-link fence that separates Cottner from the side of the 405 freeway. Resident Lincoln Briggs explains.
This is city property. The other side of that fence is Caltrans. It's state property. Now, from a practical standpoint, what that means to us is this is LAPD. That is Highway Patrol. It's a sheriff. So we jump back and forth.
Avoiding law enforcement, mostly. You'll hear about that shortly.
I know that it's been too long.
Lincoln Briggs is a musician. So are the three friends he came here with. Sometimes they jam late at night. This is Lincoln's friend Kirk Parrish singing.
Carpets of red, skies blue. Some coming through the field.
In some ways, the place they call Hobotown resembles any other LA neighborhood. There is the woman who always complains about her neighbors making too much noise. She just walks over to the nearest police station, the cops say. There's the town elder, Peebles. But, as he confirms, in most ways this encampment is a lot different from the other communities of West LA.
I know everyone here.
And are you friends?
Be truthful to you, if it wasn't for the drugs, I think we'd all be separated.
What kind of drugs?
Around here is mostly alcohol, marijuana, speed, and heroin.
About a month ago, a man overdosed on heroin and died in the encampment. He was in his 20s. His name was Michael. Lincoln Briggs was sleeping in the tent next door, and Briggs calls himself a massive drug user.
It's much easier to live under a dumpster when you got your drink. And that's just a fact. And it is what it is. You know, and it's a lot easier to roam endlessly walking until your feet are worn off and you're on bloody stumps of ankles when you're high. And that's just a fact. I need my drink. I live under a dumpster. And I'm sorry. It does help. Help me forget. Help me numb. Whatever it is, you know. That's just the reality of my situation. I think many people's situation around here.
Another encampment resident said he feels like he lives in a whole different city than the drivers on the freeway just a few yards away. Yet, Briggs used to be one of those drivers. He says he used to work as a royalties accountant in the music industry.
I used to have, like, jobs and lives and a career and houses and all these things. And I drove on that 405 highway every day for years. Every day. Drove right past here.
Briggs' father, David, was even a big music producer who worked on more than a dozen Neil Young albums. He died 20 years ago. Briggs has been homeless 5 times in his life, starting when he was 14. Now he's 44, and this has been the longest stretch he's had on the streets, 3 years. He says he wants to change his life, maybe even have a family someday, but the longer he's homeless, the more hopeless he feels.
It's left an indelible imprint on me as a person. And now I'm trapped, and I'm very much cornered and completely out of the flow of society and on all levels. When you get below the bottom rung of society, it's very difficult to get a grip on the ladder or whatever, and get it back together.
If the city provided encampments with basic services, Briggs says, it would help them feel more integrated with society, less dehumanized.
We got nowhere else to go. This is the best case scenario. Let us coexist and survive, and we will do our part if you give us a chance to be able to take care of the street. You might be surprised.
For now, though, when the encampment gets too crowded, too cluttered, the city cracks down. Every few months, police post signs along Cotner Avenue warning residents that a sweep is coming. Then, 3 days later, police and sanitation workers clear everyone out. And for the next few days, the cops keep an extra presence on the street, like this one.
Well, we're cleaning up.
Oh, you are?
Yeah, we posted the signs. The signs posted for cleanup, so it's cleaned up. That's why it's different today.
For a short time, Hobotown disappears. But within a couple of weeks, business owners say, the homeless always come back. It's a cycle that Paul Koretz, the councilman, admits will probably keep repeating for the foreseeable future. City officials, he says, are trying to figure out why homelessness is up so dramatically across the city and what they can do about it. And until that's solved, encampments like this aren't going anywhere. For Press Play, I'm Anna Scott.
All right, we'd like to hear from you. Have you noticed more homeless encampments in your neighborhood? What do you think? What do you think should be done about it? Let us know 1-844-PRESS-PLAY or leave a comment on our Facebook page, KCRW Press Play. Coming up, we'll look at one possible reason for the homelessness increase. Proposition 47, enacted last year, it downgraded some felonies to misdemeanors, so there have been fewer arrests for drug possession. We'll have that story next on Press Play.
Take KCRW with you on one of our smartphone apps. Available for the iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry. You can stream KCRW live, listen to podcasts, and all our news and music streams. Learn more and download at kcrw.com/apps.
You're listening to Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. We just heard from a homeless encampment on the west side of L.A. These encampments have spread in the last year far beyond Skid Row. Homelessness on the streets has gone up 12% since 2013. So could one reason be Proposition 47? It's been a year since Prop 47 passed. That's the measure that reduced some drug and property crimes from felonies to misdemeanors, meaning less or no jail time for crimes like shoplifting, drug possession, burglary. Critics are blaming it for an increase in crime. They also say it reduces the incentive for drug users to enter court-ordered rehab. Defenders say the measure is having the effect it is supposed to, reducing the number of people in California's overcrowded prisons and jails and saving the state lots of money. Well, here to talk about the effects of this law 1 year in is Michael Brennan, law professor at USC, where he runs the Post-Conviction Justice Project. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
My pleasure. So what do you think? We just heard that story. You listened to it about the homeless encampment. They are everywhere in Los Angeles. And noted that the statistics for jail people in jails statewide down 11.7% in the last year. Meanwhile, homelessness up 12% in the last 2 years. So do you think there is a connection to between homelessness and Proposition 47?
I really don't. I think they're two separate problems. And I haven't, you know, been aware of anything that connects the two. Most of the people committing felony and or misdemeanor offenses are not homeless. While some of the inmates who are released from prison might become homeless, I don't think a substantial percentage would or have. And so I really don't see a very direct connection.
No, even though that many of the people that Anna interviewed for that story are drug addicts, and lots of drug addicts do commit petty crimes to support their habits.
No question about that. And but you know, I really just don't see an awful lot of homeless people being prosecuted for felony and or misdemeanor crimes, and you know, and have, you know, and I just don't see Prop 47, you know, being directly related to that issue. I certainly could be wrong. I just haven't seen any information that would connect the two.
I want to bring in LA County Sheriff Jim McDonald right now to this conversation. Welcome to the program.
No, thank you for having me.
All right. So I understand that narcotics arrests are down significantly, 30% in your department. Are officers less willing to arrest someone now for minor offenses, given that they, you know, probably won't result in any jail time?
You know, well, we've tried to set the tone that each one of these is an important arrest in that it affects quality of life, if not a felony, certainly through misdemeanor enforcement. The reality is that the time it takes to arrest and book and get medical treatment for an individual takes them out of the field for a long period of time. So when they do the cost-benefit analysis in their head as to how long is this person going to be out of circulation if that person is somebody that they know are offending over and over again, and they know that they're going to be released as soon as before they get the reports done, then that certainly, I'm sure, weighs into their calculus.
And so do you think that's a result of Proposition 47?
Oh, sure.
Okay. So there are fewer arrests. So does that mean crime is up because of Prop 47?
I wouldn't say it's up solely because of Prop 47. I know there's a number of factors that weigh into that. When you look at what's going on nationally, it's up outside of California as well.
Mm-hmm.
But certainly, I believe 47 has played a contributory role to the increase in crime that we've seen throughout California. And when you look at it, just, you know, for somebody who doesn't do this every day, and you realize that somebody who's out there, and all of a sudden the sanctions that were in place previously for a felony for somebody who's in possession of marijuana, cocaine, PCP, heroin, any of the hard drugs, straight possession is no longer a felony. So our goal is to be able to try and help people get back on the straight and narrow through treatment. And we no longer have the ability to be able to get someone into treatment with the threat of having to do time otherwise. And somebody who's an addict, they need that coercion, if you will, or the leverage to be able to give them that option that's better than the alternative. And we no longer have that.
And so, as I don't know if you were able to hear that last piece from the homeless.
I just came on. No, I'm sorry.
Okay, so we went to a homeless encampment, and many of the people that our producer interviewed are drug addicts.
Right.
They're doing methamphetamine and other drugs. Do you think that there is a link then between Prop 47 and the spread of these homeless encampments?
Well, when you look at the homeless encampments, many of the homeless people that we deal with, we're dealing with a number of different issues. They're dealing with mental health issues. They're dealing with addiction issues for alcohol and drugs. And so it's not something where you could isolate it and say that it's as simple as, you know, they're homeless as a result of one incident or one set of circumstances. It's pretty multifaceted in that regard. But I do believe that many of our homeless population that are mentally ill have co-occurring addiction issues as well.
Okay, so Michael Brennan, I want to bring you back in the conversation. You just heard the sheriff say that the Prop 47 provides a disincentive to enter court-ordered drug programs. What do you make of that?
Well, I think that's probably true. If someone a year ago was facing a possible felony conviction and sentence and had the alternative of going to a drug program, that's a pretty easy choice. If he's not faced with that alternative any longer, a disincentive to go to the program. I think, though, that, you know, the flip side of it is, what is the success rate of people who do go into drug programs? In my experience, and that's sort of anecdotal as a former defense attorney, people participate in these programs and finish their program time and go right back out on the street and start using again. So I think it's very hard to, you know, say that the drug programs are really the answer. People have to be ready to stop using drugs. And if they are, then the programs are very helpful. If they aren't, they're just taking up space.
Right. And so then having the threat of going to jail for a significant period of time might be a good incentive to get people into the program.
It would certainly get them into the program,
but not stay.
For some of those people, it's certainly a benefit. For a lot of them, it isn't, just because they don't have any real, personal incentive to stop using.
So, what is your overall assessment of Prop 47? Do you think that it is working as it was intended?
Well, I think it's working to the extent that we're reducing the prison population and the jail population. We're saving a lot of money. We're not, sending defendants to state prison for relatively minor crimes. So from that perspective, I think it's working. Whether there are downside problems with the proposition, I think we're going to have to look at that over a little longer period of time. We're talking about a year now, and so I think it's pretty hard to draw any hard and fast conclusions at this point.
And what is your hypothesis for why homelessness has increased, street homelessness?
Well, as the sheriff said, I think that is a combination of problems, drug problems. Many of these people have, you know, practically no hope of being employed. They've kind of dropped out of the society altogether for all kinds of reasons. And we're really not providing much in the way of alternatives to these homeless camps. You know, if they had some place to go and hopefully get, you know, some help with their addiction problems, you know, they might be able to get off the street. But I don't see a lot of those kinds of possibilities right now.
All right, Sheriff, and what do you think? I mean, do you think that Proposition 47 needs to be redone?
You know, I do. I think we need to take the data we have now for a year. And I agree that the data is not as complete as it would be probably 5 years from now. But in the interim, how many victims are we going to allow to or people to be victimized? When you look at the Prop 47 arrests that have been made, of those arrested, about half have been rearrested, some as many as 13 or more times for an additional 40,000 crimes. And those crimes include murder, rape, robbery, aggravated assault, burglary, GTA. So the intent, I think, was to deal with people who are first-time drug offenders, who are stealing small amounts to support their habit, get them into treatment. And when I look at, you know, where are we a year into this, I don't know that we've achieved that. The savings in dollars, I think, in certainly in L.A. County, and I can't speak for the rest, has been negligible, because the people who are not coming in the front door now and being processed and being held in our custody, that does not create a vacancy, if you will, because what we're doing is keeping the people who are sentenced for a greater amount of their time. Previously, somebody would be sentenced, and if you get sentenced to a year, it's automatically half of that, and then they were doing 20% of that. So not much of a disincentive for committing the crimes that we're committing. We've upped that to 90% at one point. It's back down to 70% now, and it's a constant triage in order to be able to minimize the overcrowding but hold people accountable for the offenses. So they are doing less time served. I agree with that. But if the goal of 47 was treatment rather than incarceration, I don't think we've done that. And the big picture that we need to focus on is that there's more victims, that crime is up, and the 10 years of significant crime reduction has turned around overnight almost, and immediately following the imposition of Prop 47.
Yeah. All right. Thanks for joining us so much, L.A. County Sheriff Jim McDonald.
Thank you very much.
Also, Michael Brennan, thanks to you.
Thank you.
Michael Brennan, clinical professor of law and director of the Post-Conviction Justice Project at USC. Coming up, a new movie tells the real story of reporters at the Boston Globe uncovering the Catholic Church's sex abuse scandal. They found that hundreds of priests abused thousands of children for decades.
Many, many of them thought they were the only ones this had ever happened to. And in many cases, we were the first people they ever told.
The reporter and editor who led the investigation are here after a news update with Eric Roy.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel. Stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage and accessible via our smartphone app or online at kcrw.com.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Spotlight is the name of the Boston Globe's team of investigative journalists. It's also the name of a new movie that opens today, based on the Spotlight team's Pulitzer Prize-winning work back in 2002, which exposed sexual abuse by Boston Catholic priests.
When you're a poor kid from a poor family, and when a priest pays attention to you, it's a big deal. How do you say no to God?
Spotlight.
Just the tip line.
You think he's got something?
I want to keep digging.
We need to focus on the institution. Show me that it came from the top down.
6% act out sexually.
6% is 90.
90 priests.
If there were 90 of these bastards, people would know.
Maybe they do.
The film stars Michael Keaton as Walter Robbie Robinson, the editor of the Spotlight team. Mark Ruffalo plays Mike Resendiz, one of Spotlight's investigative reporters. And the real Robbie Robinson and Mike Resendiz join me now. Welcome.
Thanks very much.
Thanks for having us.
So your investigation eventually led to basically the worldwide Catholic priest abuse scandal. But initially, and this is portrayed in the film, there's some resistance to taking on this investigation, to actually going for it. And it's brought to you by the new executive editor, Marty Baron. He's an outsider, as noted in the movie. He is unmarried and Jewish and not from Boston. And he's the one who sort of goads you into or encourages you into pursuing this. Is that an accurate portrayal? This is what I'm seeing in the movie. Is that actually what happened? And can you talk about those initial conversations?
Sure. And by the way, he also didn't like baseball. An unmarried man of the Jewish faith who doesn't like baseball.
So immediately suspicious.
Immediately suspicious.
And bound to stick out in Boston and not fit in at all.
And the day he arrived to take control of this ship, the Boston Globe, July 30th, 2001, he walked into his very first news meeting, and he asked everybody if they had read a column the prior day by Eileen McNamara, who wrote about these lawsuits, 84 lawsuits against one priest, John Gagan, and that the court had put the personnel records of this priest under seal. And Eileen had written in her column, "The truth may never be known." And to Marty Baron, that's like a red flag. And his first day, he said he decided to go to court to seek those records. And he called myself and Ben Bradley Jr., my superior, into his office and asked the Spotlight team to begin investigating the case of this one priest. And with great reporters like Mike Resendez, Sasha Pfeiffer, and Matt Carroll, we pretty quickly discovered that Gagan was the tip of a very large iceberg and there were many, many priests involved.
But you had written about this before, or the paper had written about this before, but hadn't realized that this was, you know, a conspiracy, that it went all the way up to the top to Cardinal Law.
That's right. That's what was so significant about what we did. I always tell people we did not discover clergy sex abuse by any means. There was a big scandal in Louisiana. There was a big scandal in Texas. And just in the neighboring diocese of Fall River, Massachusetts, there was a big scandal that the Globe covered kind of relentlessly. What made this story different from all the others is that we were able to prove the cover-up. We were able to prove that Cardinal Law knew that a priest had molested more than 150 children over three decades in six parishes and still assigned him to the altar boys in his final assignment. That's what broke the thing wide open and was different than what anyone else had ever reported.
But here you are reporting on, this is a company town, right? I mean, this is a Catholic town, Boston.
Sure,
absolutely.
And you all went to Catholic schools. Was it harder then to report on this story because of that?
You know, I actually think it was easier since the four of us on the team were all raised Catholic. We sort of understood the culture of the church. We were raised in the church. I myself went to 12 years of Catholic education, including the Jesuit high school, which is right across the street from the Globe. And so getting into the story, we sort of kind of got it. So it wasn't that more difficult. And Boston, of course, was the most Catholic of the major archdioceses
right.
in the country. I mean, more than half of the population is nominally Catholic. And, you know, this is true in every major city in the country. There's an archdiocese, there's a major newspaper. And for years and years, nobody suspected that it was possible that such an iconic institution in Boston or anywhere else could have basically countenanced, enabled, and covered up the sexual abuse of thousands and thousands of children.
And it was our Catholic background, I think, that made it easier for us to understand how this might happen, on the other hand, than it might have been for other people. For instance, many people came up to me after we broke the story and said, well, how could anyone leave their children alone with a priest, with a strange man? And if you were raised Catholic, you would know that the priest would be the one person you would leave your mm-hmm. children with, be the one person you would trust implicitly with your family would be a priest. So we understood the phenomenon, and it gave us an entree into the lives of some of the victims and survivors that I think other reporters might not have had.
What was it like interviewing the survivors?
Well, it was colossally sad, for one thing. I mean, we heard story after story about how people's lives had been literally destroyed or changed forever by priests who had betrayed them.
I mean, once we broke the first story, and soon after that, the first story about the scope of the problem, initially we confirmed that there were at least 70 priests involved. But our phones literally rang off the hook for weeks and weeks, and we interviewed more than 300 victims just in the Boston Archdiocese. And because this story broke just at the dawn of the internet age, it went viral. And within 2 days, we were getting calls from Australia, New Zealand, Ireland, all across the U.S., people wanting to tell their stories. And one of the common themes is that many, many of them thought they were the only ones this had ever happened to. And in many cases, we were the first people they ever told.
Wow. And I'm wondering when it broke if other reporters from other cities called you to find out how you did it and how they could replicate the same kind of investigation in their cities.
Sure they did. They wanted to know what we did, how we did it. And in particular, they wanted to get copies of the legal documents that the Globe filed to overturn the confidentiality order in the Gagan case. And many other papers filed motions similar to ours, and some were successful and some were not.
So there are many dioceses and archdioceses in the country where people who live there have no idea of the scope of the problem in their own backyard because in their dioceses, the records just haven't been made public.
If you're just joining me, I'm speaking with Mike Resendiz and Walter Robbie Robinson, members of Boston Globe's Spotlight reporting team. They won the Pulitzer Prize for exposing abuse by priests in Boston back in 2002, and their story is the basis for a new film. It's called Spotlight, which opens today. You have to wonder how much of the film is exactly accurate and how much of it is poetic license.
Well, look, this film brilliantly compresses 5 months of our lives into 2 hours. So there are a lot of scenes that are conflated. There are a few scenes that are fictionalized. But I got to say, you know, most of the time when you see a movie that's based on a true story, it seems that it's sort of based on a true story. But this one is really, really based on a true story. I mean, I think it's incredibly accurate.
There's a scene where your colleague, Sasha Pfeiffer, goes and interviews a priest, knocks on the door. He opens the door. She seems a little taken aback that he opens the door. And she says, well, I've just interviewed some victims who said that you molested them. Is that true? And he says, yes, right, very candidly.
He didn't.
Did that happen?
That did happen. He admitted his crimes. He admitted he molested children. And we had a story ready to go about him because one of the children he molested, he actually killed because he was driving drunk, had a car accident, returning from a camp where he had molested the kid, and the kid died in the accident.
And why was he so forthcoming admitting this?
You know, this is a wonderful moment, I think. And if I were teaching journalism, I would use this as a teaching moment. Because one of the things we learned that we learn over and over and over again is never make assumptions. Never assume that a priest who has something to hide or should have something to hide won't talk to you. Never assume that anyone won't talk to you. People have all kinds of reasons for wanting to talk. We don't know what they are.
And so why did he speak so candidly?
You know, I think some of these priests were so ill, I don't know how to describe it psychologically, that they didn't think what they had done was wrong.
I think it's very true. I mean, as a matter of fact, it's a classic characteristic of pedophilia where the pedophiles don't believe what they're doing is wrong. It's one of the reasons it's so hard to cure them or alter their behavior.
There was one priest also interviewed by Sasha who we got his personnel file, and in it he admitted that when he was running a program for young high school girls who were going to become nuns, that he had sexual relations with them so he could teach them what it was like to be in communion with God, and he was God to them. And we couldn't believe it. We thought somebody made the file up, and Sasha called him up, got him on the phone, and he admitted the whole thing. He said, I was God. I was God's likeness to them, and I was teaching them how to be intimate with the Lord. Those are actual words.
Wow.
And so that's the mentality some of these priests have.
Yeah.
There's also within the Catholic Church what's been called a culture of clericalism, where the priests believe they live in a separate society, which they do, which is higher than the rest of society. Often, while reporting the story, I was reminded of covering the police. I mean, the police, the first thing the police do when there is trouble is they protect one another. That is the first thing they do. And I feel it's the same way with the clergy. The first thing they do at the sign of trouble is to protect one another and to protect the institution of the Catholic Church. And that comes before protecting children.
Where is the church now on this? Do you think that they have reformed? Do you think there's a lot of work to be done?
They've in the United States especially, taken steps in some dioceses and archdioceses, certainly in Boston, they've taken major steps to do training, to do background checks on people. There's a lot more monitoring of what goes on. But, you know, there are still too many incidents in too many places in the United States that show that bishops still don't get it. They still protect offending priests. Some offending priests still end up in ministry. And you know what? We have a new pope who thinks that things are really being done well here, and that may be because in other countries, virtually no steps have been taken to, for instance, even remove priests from ministry who have abused children. So the church has a long, long way to go, and one hopes, we hope, that this film will spotlight or shine a considerably more public attention on this issue.
Have survivors seen the movie?
Yes, survivors have seen the movie. The survivors who are depicted in the movie have seen it, and there was a special screening of the movie in Boston for survivors. And I think the most gratifying aspect of this, without any reservation, is the fact that survivors have said they really like the movie and feel it supports them and furthers their cause, and that's been truly gratifying.
You know, Robbie, one of the more interesting aspects of the film is that your character, you don't have a halo in this movie, and you're seen as flawed in that you were the editor of, I guess it was the Metro desk at the time.
The Metro section,
yeah. Right. When the story was written of a couple dozen priests, I guess, who were accused of abuse.
20.
And the story just died. And there's a moment in the movie where you feel really culpable. Is that accurate?
No. It's partly accurate in that the Globe in 1993 did run an article with a headline that said, lawyer notifies church he has found allegations against 20 priests. Many of them were either deceased or retired. But we ran that article deep inside the paper. At the time, 8 years later, we were doing our investigation. We couldn't find that article. We found a similar article that ran the same day in the other paper in town, the Herald. So we were aware of that. None of us remembered. I mean, it was the screenwriter, Josh Singer, who actually found this article in 2012. And I was the new Metro editor at the time. I actually believe I was on a golf trip that week, but it was on my watch. Mm-hmm. But we ran the story, and somehow nobody, I guess, no senior editor, nobody called attention to it. It was one of those, but you know, in every archdiocese had a major newspaper, and in every archdiocese there were clues that went unnoticed for years because people frankly couldn't believe that this was that widespread. At least in Boston, we sort of cracked the code and got to the extent of the abuse first.
Well, I want to thank you both for coming in today.
Thank you for having us.
Mike Resendez, Walter Robbie Robinson, members of the Boston Globe Spotlight investigative reporting team that won the Pulitzer Prize for exposing abuse in the Boston Catholic Archdiocese in 2002. Their story is the basis of the new film Spotlight, starring Michael Keaton and Mark Ruffalo. It opens tonight. And coming up on the show, our film reviewers give us their opinion on Spotlight and Bond, James Bond. Is it good? Not good? We'll find out in our Friday film review segment next on Press Play.
This podcast is produced by KCRW, a nonprofit public radio station based in Los Angeles. We rely on listeners like you. Support the podcasts you love by becoming a member. Go to kcrw.com/join.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. We're going to get a review of Spotlight as well as the other new releases this week, including Bond. The newest installment of the franchise is out today, and the New York Times says there's nothing surprising in Spectre. Well, does there need to be? Like its protagonist, the Bond series may be unkillable. Let's start there on our Friday film roundup. Joining me, Kyle Buchanan, senior editor for New York Magazine's Vulture.com. Hi, Kyle.
Thanks for having me.
Great to have you. And Matt Atchity, editor-in-chief of Rotten Tomatoes. Welcome back.
Always great to be here.
Great to have you. Okay, Spectre. Do we need to hear a clip from this, or can we just make explosion sounds for 30 seconds?
Right, can we just go, ba-da-ba-da?
So, Matt, same old, same old?
Kinda. Yeah, you know, look, Spectre is suffering from having to follow Skyfall, right? Skyfall is practically the Citizen Kane of Bond movies.
Really?
Skyfall is such a great film and has an actual emotional arc. And you feel for Bond and M in that movie in a way that you never have in any of the other Bond movies. So when you get something like Spectre, which is action-packed and kind of a lighter, frothier, more shallow Bond film, you can't help but look and say, God, Skyfall was great. What are you guys doing?
Well, it's funny because it's a challenge of their own making. This movie is directed by Sam Mendes, so was the last one, Skyfall. And when he made that film, in most of the interviews he did, he said he couldn't conceive of making another Bond film because he packed everything he ever wanted to do into that movie. Well,
and
I guess
a bunch
they,
of greenbacks were waved in front of
him. They backed up that Brinks truck and they said, well, think of something else. And yes, you can really see, feel them straining to. I don't think that this is a movie that's sort of bursting with ideas or invention or even a sort of enthusiasm. It's very competently done, but that's about all I can say about
it. It feels like a greatest hits tour. You see a lot of elements that you've seen in a lot of other Bond movies and a lot of action movies, and it all works fine, although there's one plot point that really bothers me because it comes out of a spy spoof, and I thought, I hit this moment where I thought, you guys are pulling this from a different spy spoof movie? I couldn't help but think of this. And I don't want to spoil anything, but when people watch it, they'll get it. They'll know.
Okay. Well, you know, do people want anything new or do they want all the same Bond stuff? They want that long opening scene. They want the gadgets. They want the cars. They want the girls.
I don't think it's impossible to take that rubric, which is pretty strict, and do something interesting with it. For my money, the best of the Daniel Craig Bonds was the first one, Casino Royale, which is a really beautiful movie with sort of modest but sort of refreshing stakes.
He seemed tortured.
Yeah, yeah, and a terrific Bond girl, Ava Green, who I think that that franchise has still struggled to match. I think that this movie sort of faints toward the idea of delivering a more traditional Bond than it has before, but there's no real sense of fun. It's leached of all color. Anything sort of comic in it has been placed there gingerly with forceps. There's nothing sort of organic. There's no excitement to it, I don't think.
I have to say, that's what I miss in the Daniel Craig Bond films, the fun, the camp factor is missing.
I disagree. I think this one's got a little bit more fun to it. I don't know that Daniel Craig successfully sells it. I feel like this movie really drags in the middle. There's kind of this tilt towards a story that wants to have some similar emotional heft and Bond questioning what he does. It just kind of doesn't work, you know. Okay. And then you get all this weird backstory that, again, my biggest problem with Casino Royale, I don't need to know the backstory of James Bond. Like, he just shows up and he's awesome, and that's fine.
Looks good in a tux.
Yeah.
Let's move on to Spotlight. We just spoke with the journalist, the real journalist behind the story. So what did you think of it as a piece of art, as a film, Kyle?
I think this film is so terrific. It's modest, but almost sort of powerful because of that it never tries to overreach, that it does what a great article ought to do, which is put together all this information and let you draw these conclusions, gently nudging you towards them. The performances are fantastic across the board. I mean, you could do a whole Best Supporting Actor category just of five people in this movie. It is a really terrific movie, and it was funny that we're talking about this after we talk about Spectre, because in Spectre there are all these moments where Bond jets off to another country. And, you know, the plot in Bond is just the barest thread of a thing. And yet I frequently found myself wondering, wait, why is he going to this other country? What is he pursuing? Even the little that Bond had to do, I was losing the plot of. Whereas in Spotlight, you've got multiple reporters following multiple threads, and you get it. You feel like you are reading this and you're putting together these aspects of the case in a really tremendous way that gives the audience a lot of credit, and that, you know, really demands that the director, Tom McCarthy, get a lot of credit because it's impeccably done.
And it's suspenseful. You wouldn't expect this to be suspenseful, but it is, man.
This is a perfect film. This movie is one of the things it does really well is it takes the grind of reporting. You know, there's certain elements that they come up with by going through the directory of priests by hand and going through those and coming up with stuff. This movie respects its audience because it doesn't spoon feed you why the reporters are doing things. You just follow along with them, but it manages to make that exciting, intense, and interesting. And so as you get into the back half of the movie, there's an emotional weight to the arguments that happen between Resendiz and Robinson that are that much more powerful because you've been following them, tracking this story. This movie it sneaks up on you how powerful it is, because, you know, it would have been easy to do a movie like this and really play for the fences, really play for the back of the theater and do it very heavy and make it kind of artificially important. This movie earns all of the emotion it does. This is one of the finest films of the year, in my opinion.
For sure.
All right, let's move on to Brooklyn. This is the adaptation of the Colm Tóibín novel. That is how you pronounce it, by the way. I looked it up. Let's hear a clip.
Step over this way, please. Get out of the line. Next. Passport, please. Welcome to the United States, ma'am.
Dear Rose, I miss you and Mother and think about you every day. The most important news is that I have a job and I'm in a boarding house.
I was glad to see you finally got some letters from home today.
I wish that I could stop feeling that I want to be an Irish girl in Ireland.
Homesickness is like most sicknesses. It will pass.
Okay, so Kyle, this is about an Irish lass in the 1950s coming to Brooklyn.
Yes. She is, as you could hear in that clip, she's sort of caught between two worlds, which is, you know, the immigrant's tale. She goes to Brooklyn and she falls for this Brooklyn boy, this New York Italian, who represents a life that she hasn't sort of dared to dream that she could have, you know, a life full of potential that's not constricted by anything. And at the same time, especially once she goes back to Ireland for a return trip to see her family, she's reminded of this life that was prescribed for her, that has safety, that has security. And there's a man there that represents that life, too. So she's caught between these two men, but she's also caught between the two sorts of people that she could be, you know, the person she's never dreamed of being and the person that everybody always told her she would be.
And what did you think? Did you like it?
Oh, it's so nice. I really love this movie. This is a movie that everybody's mom is going to love. And I think that's significant. It's really a bygone movie in a lot of ways. It's very classically told. But it also reminds you of an era, you know, long before social media, where when you did pursue a whole new life somewhere else, it meant literally leaving your old life behind. You might never see your family again. And it took such courage and bravery for people to be able to do that.
And Matt, this is something that could be cloying, nostalgic, sepia tone, blech.
And it manages to dodge all of that. You know, this is the same kind of magical New York that you see in something like When Harry Met Sally, right? But they make it work. This is a really sweet immigrant story about a woman who comes to the U.S. and blossoms and makes the people around her better for having come as well. You know, she falls for this Italian boy played by Emery Cohen, who's almost doing a little bit of a Brando thing without being, you know, without the affectation. But he's this earthy, really interesting character that brings out the best in her. And she, you know, again, she kind of blossoms with him. And I found myself when she goes back to Ireland and as fate is kind of conspiring to keep her there, I got really anxious in a way that I hadn't expected. And I kind of had this, I consciously thought, oh, God, I'm worried she's not going to go back. And this is another one similar to Spotlight where the emotion of it sneaks up on you. And in the hands of lesser filmmakers, this would have gone into something that's cloying and kind of forgettable. And this is a really great movie. And Saoirse Ronan is great. Donald Gleason, really, really good in this. Jim Broadbent, what little screen time he has, really, really well cast in there. This is a movie that I would absolutely recommend people go out and see.
Okay, finally, let's talk about a movie set in the same time period, Trumbo.
Are you not, or have you ever been a member of the Communist Party?
Many questions can be answered yes or no only by a moron or a slave.
No studio will ever employ a member of the Communist Party.
Decent Americans feel that Hollywood is just a haven for overpaid traitors.
Okay, I feel like I should have jazz hands now. So this is Bryan Cranston playing Dalton Trumbo, the screenwriter who was blacklisted in the 1950s.
This is the best cast history lesson I've ever seen. The cast is great, and everybody puts in pretty good performances. And you get all of the important points of the HUAC hearings and kind of the imprisonment that he goes through, that Trumbo gets, you know, he does 11 months in prison, and then him working under the blacklist. But it never hits emotionally the way it needs to. You never really feel a sense of urgency in here. That's really frustrating. There's a couple of filmmaking missteps in this where Trumbo goes off to prison for 11 months and he comes back and his daughter is now Elle Fanning, who's suddenly 6 feet tall and she was this little girl in 11 months. I mean, puberty's fast, but not that fast. The other issue that I had with this film is that Cranston is kind of doing a voice here, and which would be fine, except that nobody else is. And everybody else is playing these really grounded performances. And the cast is all excellent, but Cranston feels like he's in a different movie. You've got you've got John Goodman and Stephen Root as the King brothers, who are great. You've got Helen Mirren as Hedda Hopper, who is the Gotham columnist, who is absolutely the villain of this movie. You got Louis C.K. as Arlen Hurd, who puts in this really great, grounded, natural performance. And then you got Michael Stuhlbarg doing Edward G. Robinson. And if anyone in the movie earns the ability to do the kind of like, give me the dough, see? Like the Edward G. Robinson voice, Stuhlbarg does, and he doesn't. And so if he's playing natural, you kind of think, God, if the guy playing Robinson isn't going for the caricature, why does anyone else get to? And it kind of takes me out of the movie a little bit. You look at what the potential could be, especially because Dalton Trumbo was one of the finest screenwriters we've ever seen. And it keeps hitting you with these amazing movies. So a mediocre movie that is constantly referencing classically amazing, beautiful, genius movies kind of shoot themselves in the foot a little bit.
Right, right.
Just so you want to watch those.
Yeah,
you want to
exactly.
go see Spartacus
right.
instead of...
It brings up Spartacus and Exodus and The Brave One and Roman Holiday. And you're thinking...
Which he wrote all of those.
Well, he wrote all of those, some of which are uncredited, as some of which won Academy Awards. And you can't help but think, God, I wish this movie was that good.
A tall order, though.
The good news is we've got two movies at least this week that you both love.
Two fantastic movies and two movies I expect will be contending for Best Picture. In fact, at this stage, I wouldn't be surprised if Spotlight ended up winning it.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with you. I thought Room was the movie to beat, but boy, Spotlight's right there.
Yeah.
All right. So this is a... Two thumbs up for journalists. Yay. We rarely get them. Matt Atchity, editor-in-chief of Rotten Tomatoes. Kyle Buchanan, senior editor for New York Magazine's Vulture.com. Thanks, you guys.
Thanks, Madeline.
Thank you.
All right, that'll do it for us today. Warren Olney and To the Point up next at 1 o'clock. So keep it right here on KCRW. Have a fantastic weekend, everyone. I'll see you on Monday.
Support for Press Play comes from the Kane Foundation. Rick and Suzanne Kane and Jenny, Maggie, and Sari Kane. The Kane Foundation is committed to enriching the cultural and civic life of Los Angeles. For over a decade, the Kane Foundation has made strategic grants to make Los Angeles a better place to live for future generations.